Hello and welcome to That Horror Show Podcast with that dynamic duo of horror, Timothy Kazza and Christopher Koenig. When you think of horror, think of us. We are a podcast like no other, so sit back, relax, and enjoy That Horror Show Podcast, if you dare.
Hello and welcome to our second episode. That's right, good old number two. Entitled, That Non-Zombie George Romero Episode, The Dark Half of Ella.
Yes! Oh, yes.
I am your host, Tim, the Capuchin Monkey Spanker, Kazda.
Boy.
And with me on today's magical journey, my darker half, Christopher 50 Shades of Grey Koenig.
All right. Wait. How do I get that? I don't understand. What's with the 50 Shades thing, you know? I
mean, the hairstyle.
Oh, whatever.
Or I should say 50 Shades of Grey.
Grey, yes. Thank you for the name, Tim.
I try.
Well appreciated.
I'm trying here.
All right.
So, Chris, how are you and what have you been up to last
month?
Oh,
what have I been doing? Well, you know, I've been doing what every person – I've been working mostly. But I will say I do have an interesting thing I'd like to mention, a little thing that I'll plug.
Oh, go ahead, shoot.
I just recently had written, I would say it's an article. I contributed an article for the paperback book known as Monster. That's with an exclamation point at the end of that. For issue 14, which was published February 25th, 2015, discussing the cult monster movie Equinox. It was not to get too deep into it because I'm hoping that you valuable listeners out there will go out there and find this book. You can find it easily on Amazon, but, I was writing about this film. It was originally called The Equinox, A Journey into the Supernatural. It was made in 1967 by Dennis Muren, who would go on to do such things as special effects for Star Wars and Jurassic Park. And, you know, he was just a young kid that wanted to, you know, make a special effects movie, and that's what he did. And it actually ended up being released in 1971 in an edited version called Equinox. But it's part of the cover reviews known as the Equinox Roundtable, where it's not just I that writes about it, but a few other contributors as well. So, please pick that one up. And, not just for my article, but other people as well that have written stuff in that. That's about all for me, Tim. How about you?
Well, I'm doing great. Thanks for asking, Chris. Right now, I'm just putting the finishing touches on my man cave that I lovingly.
Why everyone?
Well, I don't call it the man cave. I'm calling that as a subject matter, but I call it the Camp Crystal Lake Bunker Home Movie Theater and Sports Bar. Now, this has been my project, my own personal project, for roughly about 4 years on and off. Now it's another place where the family can get together, watch movies, and eat popcorn. It's a place I can retreat to and watch movies with the surround sound on while the kids are sleeping and taking their naps in the afternoon. And another place for, to hold parties. So it's a win-win.
You said you call it the Camp Crystal Lake.
The Camp it's a little bit long, but it's called the Camp Crystal Lake Bunker Home Movie Theater and Sports Bar.
Now, since it's called the Camp Crystal Lake Bunker, does a killer in a mask show up and, try to create all sorts of mayhem and ridiculousness that just, makes the experience so much more fun or great or what? I mean,
I haven't thought about it that far.
I know, but I've got
a couple of masks, so maybe.
Okay, but it's just when I hear that, I just, you know.
Well, I was thinking more the bunker was from the olden days, with the bomb shelters.
Oh, yeah. So you do have some food stocked under there?
Oh, yeah. I've got microwave popcorn, so I hope the power doesn't go out because I got microwave popcorn, water.
Do you have a radioactive suit down there as well?
Not yet. I just finished paying off my couch.
Tim made a bunker unless you have that suit. I'm just telling you straight up. You have to. If you're going to go all the way, you have to go all the way. There's no half measures.
That's what she said.
Yes, that's true. But I'm not trying to give him a hard time.
No. It's all good. It's all good ribbing.
It's all fun, yeah.
That's what she said.
When the mics turn off, then the punching sounds begin.
it's going good. I mean, the basement's almost all together. It's awesome. Other than that, I just registered for my third for Chicago Marathon.
Ooh,
so it's a lottery this year, so I'm hoping to get in, and it would make it extra special this year or this time around is that my wife is also joining. So I'm hoping that we both get in so we both can experience this together, because I know she wanted to run for the last few years, but she was, you know, pregnant with our children and other things came up. So this year we're both in it, and I hope we both get picked.
See, that's great, man. See, I don't think I can do that, to tell you the God's honest truth, because if anything, I'd probably be the guy who, like, runs, and then all of a sudden I hail a cab and then get to halfway to the finish.
Well,
I mean, I'm not trying to sound like I'm awful, but it's just, it's one of those things where the running capacity is just too much.
Well, you know, if you watch horror movies, you know you have to have great stamina to run away from the killer.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I'd be around the same wavelength, I was going to say. Now, if they had someone chasing us with a machete or an axe or a tomahawk or something that would, like, try to kill me, you know, maybe then I'll put the extra effort.
Well, then maybe this will be for you. In October, they have a zombie 5K run.
Okay.
And at the end, you could either run as a zombie or run as a human. And at the end of the 5K, you get a beer. And there's a party, so.
But you see, that it's all an act. I mean, if it, obviously no such thing exists, but if there were real zombies that were going to try to chase me, then yes, I would, like, an actual bullfight. You know, the bull run.
So you want to run in Pamplona?
Yeah, I would. If I was told, look, Chris, you know, we're going to have you run, and there's going to be actual bulls chasing you. I mean, that would up the challenge a little bit. It would make me, like, actually put effort into the running.
Yeah,
you
wouldn't want a horn in your ass.
Of course. God. But still. No, but it's just, you know, I mean, the idea of it is that, like I said, if it was real zombies chasing, it would give me an initiative is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, no, I understand.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, other than that, took the kids to see Disney Junior Disney Junior Live, and that was interesting. My son enjoyed it, and I didn't want to kill myself at the end, so it was a win-win for a family fun day.
But, I'm sorry, the way you just said that, I didn't want to kill yourself.
Well, you know, you go sometimes some of these kiddie acts, you know, you just want to put a gun in your mouth.
Yeah,
but this was actually quite entertaining. Disney put on a good show, and my son enjoyed the pirates, so it was good. So we had that, and we went to Portillo, so win-win.
That sounds like a win-win.
Oh, but yeah, that's about it, man. But, you know, I want to say before we get to our main event of our episode, you're lucky you. We have a brand new segment we like to call What We Watched, which is a movie and television show that we watched and reviewed that's not related to our episode. The movie or television show does not have to be horror-related. So with that, let's turn on the boob tube.
See anything suspicious when you looked back to the truck?
They've taken my daughter. I need to know right now, what are you doing to help?
You lost that girl! Because it's his fault. This whole thing is his fault.
You people can't even do your job. All you can do is turn my wife against me. If you think that I did this, you...
There's a kidnapper, and there's a watcher.
They might be watching me.
Who's watching you?
We were on a break.
Chris, would you like to lead off on our first segment?
Oh, absolutely. I have no problem with that. I was going to volunteer to go first anyway, but you made the call there, so I'll take it away.
Fire away.
Well, the one movie that I saw recently was called The Captive. It was made in 2014 by director co-writer Adam Egoyan. It's told in a series of flashbacks. The Captive involves a family man, Matthew, played by Ryan Reynolds, and his wife, Tina, played by Mireille Enos, trying to find their daughter, Cassandra, who was abducted 9 years ago and hasn't been seen since. And ever since Cassandra went missing, the police continue to suspect Matthew set up a phony kidnapping and sold his daughter to be used on the internet for, you know, various perverted activities, you know. But Cassandra is being held captive in a secret room by a local developer named Mika, played by Kevin Durand, who intends to continue holding her prisoner as well as take pleasure in watching her parents suffer over Cassandra's absence. Now, in all honesty, I'm not too familiar with director Adam Egoyan's filmography, so I really can't comment on the whole body of his work. However, I can definitely say The Captive is a fairly decent thriller that manages to hold your attention with its mysterious setup and its wintry settings. And, I mean, I will be honest, I'm not a big fan of Ryan Reynolds, but he's not bad in The Captive, which could be categorized as one of his more, quote, serious, unquote, roles. Reynolds does well playing the concerned father, and he's trying to find his lost daughter, and, you know, he plays the emotions well. I will say I did take major issue with the Morel Ennis' performance as the overly emotional mother who constantly rants and raves and blames Reynolds for the loss of their daughter. It's like it's no help that the character is written that way, as she's so annoying and shrill that I was hoping for a scene in which Reynolds would finally take her out back and shut her up by taking a closed fist to her face. But, you know, no such scene ever occurs, and it comes off as a wasted opportunity. So if you ask me, it does. But as decent as the film is, I will say that the director does make the mistake of relying way too much on telling, like, the story via a series of flashbacks, which are too scattered about with the narrative. And, you know, it comes off as too intrusive when one is trying to follow the storyline in a straight line manner. But, you know, even with all that said, you know, while The Captive isn't a perfect thriller, I will say that it is a reasonably decent one that is worth the rental. I mean, it's not a great movie, but it's average at best, and you'll walk away being entertained, so... And that's all I've got to say on this one.
Oh, wow. Well, no, when you told me about that, I looked up the trailer, and I was intrigued by it. And so I'm going to definitely check it out.
Yeah, it's not a bad film. I mean, and I will say it's one of the few thrillers made now that actually is willing to I'm not going to give it away, but I'm just going to say that it has a nice concluding ending, because nowadays every thriller that I've seen, they want to end it on a cut-to-black note, like in I'm sure everybody remembers the final Sopranos episode where, you know...
Wait, don't ruin it for me. I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, yeah. But, I mean, if you've seen the final episode of Sopranos, yeah, then you'll kind of know what I'm talking about.
Or pretty much any zombie movie.
Yeah, or any... I remember I reviewed the movie Killer Joe.
Okay.
In our older Severpod, you know, and then that film just ends by cutting to black before there's even the conclusion. And that's become such a common... ending trick that's being used nowadays, which I honestly think is ridiculous.
Do you think it's kind of sloppy?
It is sloppy.
Because, I mean, I know why they originally probably tried to do it, to try to make the audience think, give up their own ending.
It's an ambiguity and that kind of thing.
Again, but if it's being done too much, it's just, I mean, like,
yeah,
I said,
it just feels like the filmmakers just copped out and said,
yeah, like,
you know,
well, we don't know.
Or like they didn't have an ending, or they said we ran out of money or whatever.
The end.
But,
cut.
Yeah, cut. That's it. But The Captive has a pretty, I think it's a satisfying ending. I mean, there's a point in that film where the ending kind of comes a little too quickly, but the ending is satisfying in my opinion. And it's not, I mean, it's not a great film, but it was entertaining. It did hold my interest, and it wasn't badly set up. I wish I didn't rely so much on using flashbacks scattered about within the narrative, because it just felt like it was choppy. But other than that, again, for a rainy day. So,
well, I will definitely check out the Captive. Well, that brings me to me. So, if you remember back, harken back to our first episode. I know it's a long time ago. I mentioned that I was binge watching a lot of television. And one of those television shows I binge-watched was a sitcom. And to me, there is only one sitcom that epitomized the early 90s, and that show, dear listeners, was Friends. It's hard to imagine, well, at least for me, that this show has been – this final broadcast was over 11 years ago, this coming May 6th. Hell, to me, when I think of the 90s, I don't think of more than 20 years ago. I think of more like a few years ago, like maybe 5 or 6. I then have to give myself a quick reminder of what the hell year it is, and then do some quick subtraction, and then I get sad. With that being said, I'm not ashamed to say that I absolutely love the series. Now, Friends aired on NBC from 1994 to 2004. It was created by David Crane and Marta Kaufman. Before the show's title before they settled on the show's title, Friends, in the early planning stages of the sitcom around December of 93, it went through a few title changes from Insomnia Cafe to Friends Like Us to finally just simply Friends. Now, the show was stars Courtney Cox as Monica Geller, Jennifer Aniston as Rachel Green, Lisa Kudrow as Phoebe Buffay and Ursula Buffay, Matt LeBlanc as Joey Tribbiani, Matthew Perry as Chandler Bing, and David Schwimmer as Dr. Ross Geller. Now, on September 22nd, 1994, Must See TV was born. From the moment that now-famous song I'll Be There For You struck its first note by the Rembrandts, I was hooked, and America was hooked as well. Now, on January 1st, the entire series, all 10 seasons, were released to Netflix. So for this past month or so, I binge-watched all 10 seasons.
Jeez, man.
Yeah, I tell you. I mean, I love the show that much. I've seen it probably 1,000 times. No joke.
Did you get any sleep at least?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But okay. I was watching at work, too, so on my phone. So for this past month or so, I was binge-watching all 10 seasons. Now, for those who don't know what the show's about, it's about a group of six friends, all in their late 20s, early 30s, living in Manhattan, trying to be both successful in their personal and professional relationships. The cast of characters are as follows. Rachel Green is the popular girl in high school. That she's been living off her rich father when she decides that she doesn't want to marry her fiancé and she leaves him at the altar. Now, in an attempt to start a new life, she shares an apartment with an old high school friend, Monica Geller, who's also a chef at a fancy restaurant and is looking to get married and settle down and have a family. Rachel then lands her first job as a waitress at Central Perk Coffee House where the gang all hangs out. Now, then there is Ross Geller, Monica's older brother, a paleontologist who works at a museum. He has secretly been in love with Rachel since high school. The viewers also find out Ross's ex-wife is a lesbian and is pregnant with his child. Next, we meet Joey and Chandler, the roommates who live across the hall from Monica and Rachel. Joey is an aspiring actor trying to make it big in television and films. The only problem is he's not that good, but he's lovable. Chandler is the sarcastic one of the bunch and always quick with a joke. Nobody really knows what he does at his job, but he works in the office building, punching numbers into a computer. Finally, we have Phoebe, the wild card of the bunch. She's a hippie chick from the streets that turned masseuse, an aspiring musician.
Jesus Christ.
I'm giving you a backstory, buddy.
I know.
She plays her folksy music at Central Perk. Phoebe's most popular song is called Smelly Cat. As I previously mentioned, I love the series. Anyone who's seen this program knows that there's incredible chemistry within the group of the 620-somethings. As a teenager myself, when this first originally aired, I can still identify with all the characters and each one of their traits. They all came across as relatable and endearing, which I believe contributed to the longevity of the series. I also find myself throwing out random quotes in different situations at any given moment. Now, over the past 10 seasons and 236 episodes, we the viewer watched all six of these characters grow up and mature. Over the course of 10 seasons, we saw many guest stars such as Elliot Gould, Tom Selleck, Giovanni Ribisi, John Favreau, Elle Macpherson, Hank Azaria, Anna Faris, Morgan Fairchild, Michael Rapaport, Bruce Willis, Adam Goldberg, Christine Taylor, Ben Stiller, Kathleen Turner, Reese Witherspoon, Sean Penn, Christina Applegate, Alec Baldwin, John Lovitz, Brad Pitt, and my personal favorite, Paul Rudd, who became the seventh unofficial member of the group for the last two seasons. And that's just to name a few. Now, the show was ranked at one point 21 on TV Guide's 50th Greatest TV Shows of All Time, and number 7 on Empire Magazine's 50th Greatest TV Shows of All Time. Then in 2013, Friends was ranked number 24 on the Writers Guild of America's 101 Best Written TV Series of All Time. So if you have not for some reason seen it, by all means check out this wonderful series. Finally, in total randomness, I was watching an old episode of Friends. There was a mock beer commercial in the episode entitled The One After the Super Bowl Part 1 that originally aired in January 28th of 96. Now, a little background on Ross's character at one point early in the season. Ross had a capuchin monkey named Marcel. Well, that commercial was called The Monkey Shine Beer with a tagline, because it's a jungle out there. So now I'm going to play this commercial for you guys now.
Can't get the monkey off your back? Then put it in your mouth with Monkey Shine Beer.
Get it, monkey! Get it, monkey! Monkey, monkey!
Monkey Shine Beer, because it's a jungle out.
So with that, this wraps up our first segment. The reason why I played this the beer commercial for you is because the first film we'll be reviewing is Monkey Shines.
Well, I was going to say now... You mentioned Friends. By the way, folks, Friends, a television show that does not feature a psychopath killing people or anybody getting cut with a chainsaw. But you mentioned Paul Rudd.
Yes. Yes.
I'm going to assume that he did that role to redeem himself from that embarrassing performance he gave in the Halloween sequel.
Way to circle it back to the horror, yes.
Halloween sequel. Which, for those of you out there that can find that episode of our old Severpod episode where we reviewed the Halloween franchise.
Oh, that was a fun
It was a fun episode, night. But it was even more fun to single out Paul Rudd's horrible performance.
Yeah, but you know the strange thing about Paul Rudd is from the time he started in that horror movie, the Halloween movie, to the time right now, the guy has not aged at all.
Oh, he looks the same.
He looks exactly the same.
You could almost like have him come back for a Halloween sequel playing that part.
Oh, dear God.
And he would not look at all aged.
Yeah. He can still play Tommy, right? Is it Tommy?
Yeah, Tommy
Jarvis.
God, he looks so confused. Well, Paul Rudd looks confused in anything. But
Was it Tommy Jarvis or was that?
It might have been. You know, it doesn't matter.
I think that was Friday the 13th.
Yeah, it doesn't matter because he just was awful.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter. It's a very forgettable film.
It is very forgettable.
But Paul is very likable. So,
but I was gonna say it's good to have someone who is a Friends fan. Personally, I'm not. I'm not making insults. I'm just saying
it's not for everybody.
It's not for everybody, but it is a long lasting show. It's amazing how I've run into people who, you know, have watched that show. And by the way, people who've watched that show, not at the time when it came out, but at the time, but now that they can go out and rent it. You know, it's like before their time and now they
see
it.
Well, with Netflix, it's finding a whole new audience. And the thing is, it's been in syndication forever.
So it has.
So in many different countries, in many different languages. I was in Romania with my wife and we were watching, and it actually came on a syndicated station, but it was an American TV show shown in Romania, but in the Turkish part of Romania. So it had Turkish subtitles to a Romanian dubbed Friends episode.
Oh, my God. It sounds so cheesy.
So basically, it took all three different kind of cultures. So you had an American television show shown in Romania with Romanian subtitles with Turkish subtitles.
Oh, my God. It reminds me
of I still didn't understand what the hell was going on.
It reminds me of a story someone said where they used to get a bootleg tape of something, and it said, it's fun to see a bootleg tape of a movie that where it's dubbed in English, but the titles are in French. The movie is subtitled in German, and for some reason, the film's end credits are in in Japanese. It doesn't make any sense, but I'm not a big Friends fan, but I see its popularity.
Yeah, and that's okay. Yeah, not a lot of people. I mean, well, I shouldn't say not a lot of people. There are some people. It's not for everybody, but majority. I mean, it's obviously found a major success, and it spawned board games and magazines books and coffee mugs and T-shirts and my God, they even went overseas in season 5 to England and shot in England for a while.
And it's funny because I'm a big Simpsons fan.
Yeah,
but I think I've kind of like with the new episodes they're doing now, I'm just done with them because I just feel like the new episodes haven't improved anything. I think the older shows,
have more timeless quality.
Have more timeless quality, and they've lasted so long. But when I watch new episodes of it now, I'm just like, it just doesn't have that factor.
I can't speak on Simpsons too much because I stopped watching probably about 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah. I mean, I'll tune in every once in a while and It didn't hold the same impact for me. It's not that I hated it or, whatever.
It just feels like their time has passed, I guess I should say.
Well, when the show's been on for like 20 years.
Yeah. But now they're like trying to compete with Family Guy where you got like, Family Guy has that random humor and then it's like the Simpsons are like, well, let's just do that. But
I did see the Family Guy Simpsons crossover and I didn't like it.
I thought it was okay. It wasn't great. But
yeah. I didn't hate it. But it just was. It just felt weird.
Yeah, it felt weird. Well, that's because they were trying to take the show that's lasted long, like The Simpsons, and cross it over with Family Guy, that's become a popular show because of its it's such an easy word to throw out there, but why not? It's tasteless humor of today, and try to cross those paths.
Right.
And
when The Simpsons first, I mean, it wasn't so much crude. It was crude, but it was smart.
It was crude for its time because the idea of a dysfunctional family.
Right. Well, yeah, this well, it was, dude, it was 89. I mean, 1989. Yeah, I mean, that yeah. just
and,
makes
and
me
that
feel
was
old
like,
again, too.
And, well, yeah, but it was like one of those turning point TV shows, especially
right.
for Fox, because they had that show and Married with Children.
And that was it.
And that was it. Yeah, and then those shows became big. Well, and then, but, well, of course, Simpsons
that,
outlasted Married with Children.
I take that back. And 21 Jump Street.
Yeah, well, 21 Jump Street, okay. But but in any case, yeah, it's just... But yes, Friends has. It's surprising how long that show has lasted in terms, even off season. So
right. So I guess with that, this wraps up our very first segment of what we watched. Now, if you, the listeners, would like us to review a movie or television show, we'd love to hear from you, and you can reach us through our official Facebook page at That Horror Show Podcast, or you can email us at thathorrorshowpodcast@gmail.com, at gmail.com with the subject line "What We Watched." So. With that, we're going to get into the main event. And Chris, could you run that trailer for Monkey Shines?
Absolutely.
A man trapped by his own body.
To Alan, to the start of his new life.
So you train monkeys? Exclusively for quadriplegics? How about if I were to donate a monkey?
She hasn't been exposed to anything weird in the lab.
No.
An animal trained to follow commands.
How am I supposed to take care of it, Jeff?
The idea is that it's going to take care of you.
She's unbelievable. She's like a miniature person.
Get rid of that bird, or so help me.
One with the mind for revenge.
So full of anger. I've had the most horrible thoughts lately.
I made up a formulation based on human memory cells. I've been injecting one of my monkeys.
I don't like this change in you, Alan.
The other with the instinct to kill.
What the hell are you doing to her?
Ella is getting out of the house, and I'm getting out with her.
You do know that that's impossible.
Man is the only animal capable of murder.
Ella, no!
Until now.
She did it for me. Did it because I wanted it done. Stop it!
From the director of Night of the Living Dead, George A. Romero, the master of terror and suspense.
You're not gonna hurt me. I'm part of you.
Monkey Shines, a new leap into terror.
Okay, Monkey Shines, 1988. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Directed by George Romero, duh. Based on the novel Monkey Shines, written by Michael Stewart, and screenplay written by George Romero. This film stars Jason, I think his name is Big as Alan Mann, John Pankow as Jeffrey Fisher, Kate McNeil as Melanie Parker, Joyce Van Patten as Dorothy Mann, his mommy, Stanley Tucci as Dr. Joe Wiseman,
Tucci.
Which I was surprised because I didn't, I was like, wow, I was like taken back.
I know, well, we'll get into it, but yes.
Yeah, yeah. And finally, Janie Turner as Linda Ackman, which she had a small role, but anyway. Now, moving on. This story is of a man with a yellow hat and his curious monkey named George. I'm sorry, wrong synopsis.
Wait a minute.
I'm sorry, I've been watching a ton of Curious George with my 3.5-year-old son. So, onto the synopsis here. Anywho, this is a story about a young man named Alan who is an extremely gifted track and field star and law student. The film opens up with Alan and his girlfriend lying in bed, basking in the morning sunlight. We see Alan preparing for his morning run by putting many bricks into his small backpack and then strapping it to his muscular back and starting his workout. It's a picture-perfect sunny day. The sun is shining, the birds are chirping, and Alan is smiling and content as he runs along his route. Then out of nowhere, a big German shepherd runs out of the yard and jumps into Alan's path. A freaked-out Alan does a quick duck-and-dodge move and swerves to get around the dog, and he is quickly hit by a truck in what I could only describe as a comical yet tragic scene.
Jeez. Well,
and we'll
I
get
mean,
to that in a
well,
minute.
Well, okay, but still.
We then see Alan on the operating table, and the viewers hear the doctors making some small talk before the operation on his back. We learn that there's damage to his C4 vertebrae and his spinal cord. Long story short, poor Alan is now quadriplegic, which means he can't move his arms or legs. Alan now has to use a motorized wheelchair to get around. His chair can be moved by using his mouth to control the chair with a small tube stick that looks like a joystick. After a very awkward welcome home party, we are introduced to Alan's well-meaning but overbearing mother, played by Joyce Van Patten. Almost classic mother-teenage-son kind of stuff going on here. Alan wants his independence and freedom as an adult, but is also struggling with this life-changing event that just occurred. He has an in-home nurse who's a real beast of a woman, personality-wise, and an annoying pet bird.
Named Bogey.
Bogey. Yeah, seriously. My God. Okay, we then get to meet his best friend, Jeffrey Fisher, a speed junkie played by John Pankow, who's experimenting with making capuchin monkeys smarter by injecting human cells into them and giving them human brain tissue to ingest. Boy, I wonder how this is going to turn out.
Mm.
Almost like he's trying to create a Planet of the Apes type scenario. Question mark? I kid, maybe.
Jesus.
Oh. Now, wanting to help his friend, he enlists the expertise of Kate McNeil, Melanie Parker, a scientist who is working to provide handicapped people with highly trained animal helpers. Jeffrey gives Ella to Kate to help train. Initially, Alan adores Ella, but the monkey seems to have gotten a jealousy issue with Alan and as he develops a slow relationship with the attractive Kate. Meanwhile, Alan starts to have strange dreams in which he experiences the world from Ella's point of view. These images end in a blazing nightmare. The same night, Alan's ex-girlfriend and her new lover, Alan's former spinal surgeon, are burned alive during a house fire. Uh-oh. Was it the monkey? Alan thinks there is a growing connection between his own inner demons and the viciousness that occurred around him. Alan tries to sever the connection with Ella, but the limitations of his high-tech wheelchair give the psychotic primate the upper hand. So with that, let's dive in. The monkey shines.
This was, I think, the beginning of George Romero's, close to the beginning of his very short-lived Hollywood career, because he was at that point making, he was working still in Pittsburgh doing films independently,
mm-hmm.
and then he was working with Richard Rubenstein, who had gotten the financing to make Dawn of the Dead, and then they did Creepshow and Knight Riders. Knight Riders is pretty good. It's a very underrated George Romero film. Not a horror film, but still good anyway.
And Creepshow is excellent.
Creepshow is excellent too, with a script written by Stephen King. And then he did Day of the Dead, which wasn't – no, not – yes, Day of the Dead, which wasn't quite as successful as Dawn. And then during that time,
but a personal favorite of mine.
Yeah, but it is a good movie.
Yeah,
too. But it wasn't very successful.
It wasn't. It didn't get much success critically as
Dawn did. Yeah. Or so during that period, Rubenstein wanted to take the company that Romero was involved with public, or at least wider. And Romero stepped away from that because he just didn't want to be involved with that kind of major responsibility. So Monkey Shines was kind of Romero's. I guess you can say his continuation of trying to remain independent. But, of course, the film would be picked up by Orion Pictures, and they would distribute – it was a mini-major studio at the time that made Terminator and Return of the Living Dead and Platoon. And this film would basically be his introduction into Hollywood, which would get him to do The Dark Half. Now, I'm going to be honest. Monkey Shines, I don't recall seeing the film that much many years ago when I was starting to get into seeing Night of the Living Dead and all the other Romero films. It's kind of odd because that's where I think I stopped. This was like right after Day of the Dead. And then, of course, didn't quite familiarize myself with Monkey Shines or The Dark Half until now. They've recently been released on Blu-ray from Shout Factory in excellent editions.
Yeah, I heard the quality is really, really
good. Oh, yeah, very good. So, Monkey Shines, I'm going to be honest, I didn't dislike this movie that much. Mm-hmm. I thought I kind of liked the concept of it.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, Romero going to a novel source, the Michael Stewart novel, which I've not read, so I really can't say anything about that.
Yeah, I've read the book or the novel probably ages ago, probably like I was 12 or 13, so it's been a long, long time.
Yeah, okay.
So when I was revisiting this movie, I was trying to make the connection, and I never got around a chance of picking up the book again before the show. But yeah, I thought the movie was decent.
It's decent, yeah.
It wasn't his best work, but it was, I could definitely see some effort. Now, I know that the studio recut the film, so I'm not really sure if that played a part in maybe the final product of it.
They didn't recut it. They changed the ending. We'll get to that because that's actually very interesting.
But I liked it. I felt it was a tad over dramatic in some places, and I felt that Jeffrey's character was he was trying. He seemed to be trying a little hard to push his lines. Like he was overacting almost.
Well, you know, I can kind of see that, but then it's considering that his character, which by the way, we should mention the Jeffrey Fisher character played by John Pankow, who tries to help the Allen character by giving him the monkey Ella. He's been experimenting with this drug for an individual named Dean Burbidge, who's played by Stephen Root.
It was his first role, too.
Yeah, it was his first role, too. Yeah, and that's interesting, not to get too far off that, but speaking of Stephen Root, it's funny seeing him in this film immediately in the back of my head. You know, like the snap in the back of my head. I'm like, oh, that's him from Boardwalk Empire. He's in that, and he's also in the Office Space. And so it's funny seeing him in this film. And he's very good in it too, but it's just funny seeing him like his first role, I guess you can say.
Yeah.
But anyways, the Jeffrey Fisher character is supposed to be taking a particular drug in here that's keeping him from sleeping because he's trying to work. So I can understand what you're saying. It feels like he's pushing his lines out, but I kind of thought that
maybe that was because of the drug.
Yeah, I thought that kind of helped the motivation.
Yeah, I guess I could see that.
There are times where I felt like maybe he was kind of pushing it.
I mean,
I can
understand the sense of urgency because he's always like on the go. He's always like hyped up out of his mind. But I liked his character. I liked what he was trying to do with it. I just thought maybe it just something didn't feel right. But what I think this movie suffers from being just a tad too long, and maybe going back to Stephen Root and the interactions between him, and then there's a scene where he has to fight off tag artists or the people who are helping picketing his work.
Picketing, by
spray painting, you know, testing monkeys and stuff like that. I just thought there was a lot of background story to that on a sub-level when basically the story needs it. I felt they needed to focus more on and making that tighter, Alan and Ella and,
there was a backstory. The backstory was that the head of the
department,
Dean Burbidge, which is played by Stephen Root. If you watch the film, you notice that there's this kind of subplot of where Burbidge is constantly trying to get Jeffrey to get information from him about what how the experiment's going.
Right, and he doesn't have anything just yet.
Yeah, and there's a scene
other than Ella.
Right, and then there's a scene in the movie where eventually Jeffrey finds that all the serum is taken, which eventually that aspect of the movie completely disappears when the film ends, when we get to the big conclusion. The film
we can only assume that the Stephen Root's character took it.
Yeah, well, then that's what happened. There was an ending. There was kind of a tag ending where Burbidge arrives back to the testing facility, and there's all these people picketing, and they're throwing stuff at him, and and he calls them a bunch of animals and whatever, and then and goes inside. And we discover that Burbage's character has taken the serum, and of course he's been experimenting it with some monkeys, or at least one of them, which we do see. And it kind of ends on that tag. It ends on this tag where they think that the experimentation is not going to end.
Right.
This scene was cut out because Orion Pictures did a test screening of it, which Romero was completely upset about. He, in the interview on the Blu-ray, he talks about that, saying that they handed out cards, and the cards always ask, what did you like most about the movie? What did you like least about the ending? And what audiences claimed that they liked least about it was the ending, which, according to Romero, wasn't quite what they were saying. They didn't say they didn't like the tag ending.
Mm-hmm.
What they didn't like about the movie was there's this let's just say there's this happy ending involving the Jason Baig character and Kate McNeil's character.
Yeah,
I don't want to give it away yet, but because we haven't gotten that point yet. But basically, that ending, which we'll probably talk about, was really what the test screening spoke out against. It wasn't the tag ending. The tag ending was supposed to be like a fun little, classic George Romero thing. But the studios didn't like it, and they cut that ending out. And by cutting that ending out, the whole subplot or the side plot involving Dean Burbidge and Jeffrey Fisher, their story kind of just goes by the wayside.
Yeah, it felt like it ended abruptly, and I'm like,
that part of it ended abruptly.
That part. And then I guess let's talk more about the interaction between Alan and Ella after he meets Kate. Because Kate is a major player in this.
She is.
She comes into Alan's life with the monkey, Ella, and sets up Ella and this wheelchair with the treats that he gives to the monkey for performing the certain tasks around the house. I mean, now he's got all this thing set up by voice command, so he shouts out different
really
numbers.
Voice command. That was
It was very very interesting. How far we've come since 25 years ago or so. it's all voice command, and then almost looks like a prehistoric phone, but it's got the punch cards for the phone number for different phone numbers. And Ella, he would say to Ella, like, call mom, and then she would grab the card, put the card in the card reader, and then the phone would dial the correct phone number. So basically, this house is completely set up for Alan to be as independent as possible with that shrill of a nurse.
Played by Romero's then wife, Christine Forrest, who is, I gotta say, she
made me want to hate her.
She was always playing like
the bitch.
Well, yeah, I don't want to say that to be mean, but she was playing that. She's
the heavy then.
She's in the dark half. She has a brief scene in the dark half.
I must have missed it.
She's the one that comes in and says, "I hope the photographers aren't taking pictures of the kids and everything." And they
She's
also in Two Evil Eyes, which was an anthology film which featured an episode directed by George Romero, an episode directed by Dario Argento. The episode that Romero directs, she plays a nurse in that too. But she doesn't quite...
So she's very typecast.
She doesn't quite play a bitchy nurse. But she is, but bitchy for different reasons.
She seems like Nurse Cratchit here.
Ratchet or whatever. Yeah. Well, he does call her. Yeah, Nurse Ratchet, yeah. But yeah, her and the annoying bird named Bogey, she claims is named after Hope from.
And I don't know why she's so pissed. She's always seemed so pissed at Alan, and there's like no reason for it.
Yeah, it's very odd that she's very pissed at him. But then there's a point in the movie where you feel like the tension's high because Alan's character is let's put it this way: the movie opens with Alan. He's like this. You almost get this feeling that his life is just going to have a great future,
Right.
He's very well built.
He's young. He's athletic.
He's with a good looking girl.
He's in school to be a lawyer. Yeah.
And then he has this horrible accident that happens to him.
Yeah. And now let's quickly talk about that. And when I said comedic, it is comedic because I kind of like laughed, even though I'm not supposed to, and it's supposed to be tragic, but the way it's filmed. You see the dog jump out and Alan run away from the dog, and you see the close up of the truck fast.
The POV shot.
Yeah, the POV of the truck, and it's a wham, and then you see the bricks in slow motion fall.
Yeah, he flies up.
And the bricks crash to the ground.
It's that dramatic thing that they got to pull. I don't know if it's the music from David Shire that also adds to it, but I do like the score. The score is decent.
Other than that, and I want to say just a little bit of the padding. I did enjoy the movie. I found that scene. I was like, this is how – when I'm looking at George Romero and how he directs certain, like, violence and, like, this just seemed like kind of, like, soft.
But this is George Romero trying to do something else within his career. And that's something that a lot of people, I think, that look at his filmography because he's best known for zombie films, forget. And he himself says that he's tried spending parts of his career – trying to do something different in the horror genre, not just the same.
I commend him for that. I commend him for trying to stretch and grow.
Monkey Shines, it's an interesting experiment. It's not
quite intended.
Yes, or an experiment in terror is the subtitle of it. But anyways, back to the Alan Mann character, he has this great life, and then all of a sudden it's just completely changed from this accident that he has that makes him a quadriplegic. So I can see that. And, of course, there's a scene in the film where he does try to attempt suicide. So there's this tension rising within the film where, because then
he's angry at the world.
But then also his girlfriend dumps him, which, of course,
and she dumps him for his surgeon.
Yeah, for a surgeon, too, played by Stanley Tucci.
Yeah, what a cock that guy was.
I know, what a bitch she was, too. She doesn't even stand by this guy. She just, like, leaves him high and dry. She doesn't even, there's no scene. There's a scene where Alan tells Jeffrey, I think she's going to leave me. He's like, no, she won't. And, of course, she does.
Yeah.
She doesn't even tell him. I mean, talk about a cold, heartless
bitch. I mean, yeah, there's, she appears like in, I want to say, maybe 3 scenes in the entire movie. She's at the party when he first gets home.
Yeah.
And she goes into the other room and she calls Jeffrey at the lab to try and say, hey, you know, your best friend's
here.
Oh,
yeah. But then she leaves.
And then she leaves. And then the next thing you see is her and Tucci, you know, at the hospital. And then the scene after that, you see them in the cabin embracing. And then the fire. There's a fire.
But anyways, yes. And then, you know, so basically for Alan's character, yeah, his life is completely turned upside down from this whole thing. And you're right. The Kate McNeil, Melanie Parker character that comes in with Ella is sort of the turning point. It does, despite the fact that, yes, Jeffrey is basically using Ella as part of this experiment, but also giving Ella to help out Alan's life.
Right.
There is kind of an interesting thing I like about that, where his character has, like, Jeffrey's character has this motivation to use Ella to help with the experiments, but at the same time, he wants to help his friend.
Right,
so
right. It's two-pronged, basically.
Yeah.
Now there's this budding relationship going on with this slow romance burn between Alan and Kate. And now there is a scene in here which was very, to me, it was arousing yet disturbing, because it's a sex scene between Alan, who's a quadriplegic, and Kate. And Kate is, like, riding on top of him, and she's got...
Yeah, okay.
And she's in the handicap bed, and she's just, you know, moaning and everything. But then they keep cutting to the monkeys in the other room, because they're in this, like, in the training facility at her house.
Yeah.
And then monkeys are going ape shit, and I'm like, I don't know if I should be aroused or what.
I don't know. I don't recall them. They cut into the monkeys. I mean, I'm sure they did, but maybe it's just...
Because she's moaning, and she's like,
okay.
And then the monkeys are screaming their heads off in the other room.
I gotta be honest, it wasn't a bad scene.
It wasn't a bad scene, but I didn't know what I should feel.
I can understand how you say it feels disturbing because the monkeys are there, but it's an okay scene. I don't hate it.
I don't hate it either.
Well, and also, Romero's not known for doing movies with sex scenes.
Yeah.
So
I think
this
is his first boob shot, right?
And probably, not his first boob shot. I think I can think of 2 other films before that had a brief boob shot.
But in a romantic setting, yes. Okay.
Probably the first. But it didn't disturb me. I mean, it's an okay scene. It wasn't bad. It's just, I can understand what you're getting at.
Yeah.
That, but
am I supposed to be aroused? Am I supposed to wonder what the monkeys are doing next room?
Hey, quadriplegic guy. He's finally, you know, and it's solid because now he's finally met the girl that actually does give a shit about him.
Right.
So
it
all comes together,
right,
folks.
Right. No, that's what she said.
Yes.
But so their relationship is starting, and all of a sudden the relationship between Ella and Alan is starting to get a little more strained. You know, what started off as them being like best buds, Ella starts to get kind of jealous of Alan and Kate, and she starts to act a little differently, and she starts to start taking out aggression using Alan's, I guess, inner demons or psychic connection or something.
There's a point in this film that I will say doesn't really work very well. It's this. Okay, well, first off, Ella's being used for a scientific experiment, which, you know, is mostly chemical-based. But here you have this bizarre element where Alan and Ella are supposed to connect through a psychic link, which is more of a physical thing, which doesn't quite jibe with the whole scientific aspect.
Right. It was kind of a stretch.
It's a stretch, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting idea. I think it had some moments, but... It just felt like it really wasn't, like, it didn't connect very well. I mean, I guess what I'm going to try to say is that Romero does a decent job of making the scenes come together, but when you sit and think about it, the idea itself, though interesting, doesn't really apply very well. It's a stretch, like you said, Tim.
Right.
But visually speaking, it's interesting, but in terms of its story and content, it's too much of a stretch.
Yeah.
The other thing is that... Well, the reason why the whole relationship between Alan and Ella sort of goes the way it goes, and sort of, you know, Jeffrey's character is using Ella for this experiment to try to see what human qualities that they can get from it, from Ella. And Ella's a female monkey, mm-hmm. So they're
played by a male monkey.
Played by a male monkey as we all know, the behind the scenes information,
right.
Yes. But the idea that it goes from a monkey that's trying to help out Alan to a monkey that has emotional feelings towards Alan's character, right, and is the result of the experiment. Or, again, part of the problem is it the results of the experiment or is it the results of the psychic link or whatever?
So right. It's very mishmash. It's very kind of muddled, and in my opinion. And what I liked about it, what I liked is kind of the eeriness of it all, is that he's at one point Alan is realizing what's going on, and he's trying to stop it.
Yeah.
He's trying to stop Ella. And Ella's going more apeshit, no pun intended, and crazier and crazier. And he's just trying to calm her down. And she's like pulling off like this, like Fatal Attraction kind of
thing.
Yeah,
it's very bizarre.
She shuts off all the power, lights candles, and puts on
so
like romantic
weird.
Music. It was so eerie.
So weird.
Sick.
But it does work in a way because it's basically because Alan's character is quadriplegic.
Right.
He's found himself in this situation that he really cannot get out of. I mean, really.
Literally.
Like, when you say, can't this guy do anything? No, he can't.
Right.
Like, even his friend Jeffrey can't, you know, because...
Well, if he wasn't high all the time.
Yeah, yeah. But anyways, yes. I mean, it's I will say, I think the film's big finale is very effective. It does have this weird vibe going for it. I will say another drawback of the movie is Romero's tendency, which... not quite a flaw, but something that does pop up with his lesser work, I'll probably say, but is that he occasionally tends to have a longer running time with his films. And Monkey Shines has,
I think
it's 120 minutes, 125, you know, and it feels like there are moments where it's like stuff wasn't needed.
Yeah. Well, I think I saw the director's cut or whatever it was, or the extended version, because mine was like 150
Yeah, well, 150
minutes. Maybe almost 2 hours.
Almost 2 hours.
Almost 2 hours.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So
yeah.
I don't think there's a director's cut of it, but almost 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah, sorry. It was like an hour 51 minutes.
And
like
I will say that Romero, like when the story is getting when it gets going, you don't really care about the running time. It's like that with me personally, Dawn of the Dead. Either version, 125 or 135, which version of it you watch, you know, doesn't really get in the way. But in the case of Monkey Shines, because the story does get a little muddled with some of its plotting, the running time does feel like it does get in the way a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff with his mother, it was kind of useless.
The Joyce Van Patten character doesn't quite. I mean, I guess the dominant mother aspect of it does sort of creep up, and it's decent, but it doesn't.
I think that less is more when it came to her.
Oh yeah. I kind of wish she wasn't really in the picture that much, to tell you the truth. I mean,
same
she
here.
Was okay, but
I mean, I like her as an actress, but I just think that she.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, she was just misused.
She was kind of like.
Or overused, I should say.
Well, she was supposed to be there to sort of trigger some element of Alan, like trying to make it clear that he doesn't want to be dominated by her, and it kind of felt like it was just, it was okay, but it really didn't set well, I guess I should say. But
yeah,
well, you know what? Let's talk about real fast the film's big climatic ending, which is
pretty epic. I mean.
Well, it's pretty, like, if you want violent Romero ending, you're getting it at this point. But it's slightly different, but still, it's there.
Yeah. And you wouldn't think, and I don't mean to sound mean or crass by this, but you wouldn't think a man in a wheelchair and a monkey battling it out would sound exciting. But
it does.
But it is.
It is.
again, so we're getting back to that scene where. Actually, Ella is completely flipped out. She's killed the mother by electrocuting her. She's attacking Jeffrey.
And kills him.
And eventually kills him.
Yeah.
She's toying with Alan by she takes a straight edge razor and walks right up to his chest and like starts dangling it in front of his face and his cheek.
And it's all effective editing too. Yeah.
Now he's trying to get, and Kate pulls up in the car and she's coming into the house and he's trying to warn her to stay away. She comes in. Ella and her kind of scrap a little bit, and it just goes batshit crazy. I mean, I don't even know where to begin.
But the best part, and again, just as a reminder to our listeners out there, yes, we do occasionally give spoiler endings, but since you're horror film fans, hopefully you've seen this film.
Or read the book.
Or read the book or whichever, you know. So if you haven't seen this film, you know, mute this part for a little bit. But anyways, it ends with basically Alan's character, you know, convincing Ella to put on music, which is Peggy Lee, a Peggy Lee song, and then getting Ella to go close to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just quickly bites her on the neck and throws her, thrashes her around like crazy.
Yeah.
And just It's I gotta say, it's one of those surprise moments where I was like, whoa, that's pretty intense, you know?
Well,
I mean,
he does say, I'm gonna rip your heart out, I'm gonna rip your head off,
or something like that. But just the idea of the scene, it's just so crazy. It's like he just, when she gets close, he just bites into her neck and just bites and bites, and the blood's coming out, and he just thrashes her head around, and it's done through so many editing shots and everything. It's really intense. I mean, I really think it's effective. It's an effective moment in the movie.
It is. Now, I kind of want to backtrack for just 1 second because we're coming towards the end of our review of this film. There's a point where Alan and Kate meet another doctor for a second opinion for
We're talking about endings here. Yes. Now, there's a scene in the film where the middle of the movie where Alan sees his hand move. Mm-hmm. But quickly, you know, not like
so he doesn't know if he should be excited or not.
Yeah,
or...
but he sees his hand move. So they go to a different doctor to get a second opinion, and the doctor tells him that basically it could have been something else besides the car accident that
it could be more psychological.
Yeah,
than...
well, like basically, like the doctor tells him that even if you didn't get hit by this car, if you woke up one morning and just got up, you could have become paralyzed. It's another abnormality within him. So basically stating that his quadriplegia will probably not be permanent, and there might be possibilities of going in for another surgery and getting him back to normal. And, of course, that creates this element of Alan being upset over his former friend, Dr. John Weissman, who ends up taking his girlfriend, which leads up to the whole thing involving the death in the cabin that's set up by Ella. But anyways, it creates this sense of hope that maybe he could be cured. And then, of course, it leads to the ending, which, by the way, is a shock ending, which was added by Romero under the request of Orion Pictures, where, you know, after the whole thing with Ella, you know, now you see Alan being placed into the surgery and the doctor is making the cut. And all of a sudden you get this alien-esque ending or brief shock where Ella pops up through his back, which actually, I will admit, did make me jump.
I didn't see that.
Oh, you didn't see that?
Wait a minute. That was a dream he had.
That was a dream.
I'm sorry. The ending. And I'm like, wait a minute. That's not the ending.
Well, I'm just leading it up to that.
Go on.
But it's a shock scene that Orion asked Romero to add, which he did. And then, of course, it was really just that moment of Ella coming out of his back was a dream.
Right.
But he's going in for surgery, and then it ends with him being able to kind of sort of...
Yeah, he's wheeled to the curb from the hospital into the van, and he kind of gets up.
So he can kind of walk a little bit. It's a happy ending.
We get the happy-clappy kind of like
which ending. Was the way how it ended, which originally led up to the scene involving Dean Burbage.
So there was more after that.
Basically, the tag was supposed to be, you know, that tag involving Dean Burbage's character was the final ending. But, of course, you know, and in fact, Romero said that the reason with the screeners, the test preview, Romero said that the test audiences were upset over the happy ending involving Alan basically having this moment to... Because audiences kind of found it hard to believe that was there some way he could get out of this quadriplegia for this?
Yeah, It seemed kind of... I guess it seemed kind of tacked on and kind of like... I mean, if they would have said like... I don't remember. I think it didn't say anything like 6 months later or a year later.
Yeah, it doesn't, but...
I think maybe if they kind of maybe did that, or maybe give like a quick... minute montage of him training or trying to like exercise and getting back, you know, through therapy.
Yeah,
maybe. I think again, I'm not a whole big Romero happy clappy ending kind of person.
It's very outside of his realm.
And again, I don't bash him for that because I like him trying, you know, him stretching his, you know, directing.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
wings.
I will say this: he does a pretty good job in this film. Like the scenes involving like with Ella and everything, they're very well edited.
Right.
I mean, and just. The pacing of those scenes work, you know, with the other plotting issues aside. The happy ending, I don't know. I mean, it's a nice ending. It's a nice caper to it. It's just one of those endings that's kind of hard to buy, I guess. So
kind of schmaltzy. I mean, you kind of want to see Alan succeed because he's been through so much. But again, you got to walk a fine line.
Yeah, it's a leap of faith ending. Yeah. But it, nevertheless, it's not a great. It's not the greatest ending, but it's. A decent caper, to the whole thing. So,
all right. Well, I guess with that, we should put Ella back in her cage and put this to bed.
Yeah.
So, I guess your final grade.
Oh, you know what? It's not the greatest of Romero's filmography, but it is worth checking out. I thought it was a decent watch. with even with its plot, some of the plotting aside, and yes, our questioning of the ending. But you know what? Check it out. It's decent.
Yeah. So final grade or star?
I'll say 2 stars. Two and a half stars.
Okay. I'll give them a letter grade, but yeah, it's about 2.5, 3 stars. So I'll give it about a B.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
So with that, we're going to be shifting gears into another of Romero's film called The Dark Half,
mm-hmm.
from 1993.
Yes.
So, Chris, will you do the honors and roll the trailer?
Yep.
Thad Beaumont has a secret.
I know all about it.
A piece of himself he keeps hidden.
You just don't want to give up George. You've become attached to him.
Locked away until he needs it.
These behaviors could be interpreted as schizophrenia.
Away from the light, safe in the shadows.
I wrote those words, and I have no recollection of doing it.
But sometimes, secrets take on a life of their own. Thad Beaumont thought he didn't need George Stark anymore.
The American way of death.
That's it.
He served his purpose. Time to lay him to rest. But George is not about to go quietly.
You really don't realize what you like when you write those books, do you? It's like watching Jekyll turn into Hyde.
We're here to question you in connection with a capital crime.
Evidence says you did it.
George Stark has somehow come to life.
Hello, George.
I can come closer to believing a ghost story than this. You're talking about a man who never was.
No!
He wants to take over your life. Can't you see that?
Based upon a book by Stephen King comes George A. Romero's masterful vision of a nightmare come true.
Are you ready? Just waiting on you.
The Dark Half.
Okay.
Ooh. All right. So, The Dark Half, 1993, written and directed, obviously, by George A. Romero, based on the novel by Stephen King. So, All right. So, The Dark Half opens in the town of Castle Rock, Maine, in 1968. 13-year-old Thad Beaumont is experiencing violent headaches that are being triggered by hearing the sound of chirping sparrows flying around. When the headaches become worse, doctors discover a strange tumor in Thad's brain and perform exploratory surgery in order to remove the said tumor. But what surgeons find is not an ordinary brain tumor. It's the remnants of an undeveloped fetus which contain an eye, a few teeth, and a nostril.
Oh, that's disgusting.
It is. And so the doctors surmise that the undeveloped embryo was a twin that was absorbed by Thad's fetus, and that the twin attempted to gestate inside Thad's brain over a period of years. But while the doctors successfully removed the mass, a huge flock of sparrows fly around the hospital. Nothing wrong or strange about that, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
23 years later, we see...
Where's Tippi Hedren?
Yes, Tippi... Where was she? Or Hitchcock, for that matter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was waiting for... Dun, 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 dun. Okay, but anyways, so...
Good evening.
23 years later, we see Thad, played by Timothy Hutton, who is now married to Liz, played by Amy Madigan, and they have two twin babies. While Thad is teaching writing at a local university, he is also a successful writer of a series of violent crime thriller novels, which are published under the pseudonym George Stark. However, his cover is out to be blown by a mysterious stranger named Fred Clausen, played by Robert Joy, a slimeball stranger from New York City who blackmails Thad to pony up some cash to keep the whole George Stark alias a secret. But Thad and Liz decide to pull a fast one on Fred by going to the press and reveal Thad's alias, as well as stage a fake, quote, death, unquote, of George Stark, and that Thad can now start anew as a more legitimate novelist. But just when all this George Stark business is put to rest, a series of gruesome murders occur toward those who participated in the staged death of the Stark alias. Sheriff Alan Pangborn, played by Michael Rooker, suspects Thad to be the one responsible for the killings. But the real murderer is actually... Wait for it. Wait for it. George Stark himself!
No way!
Oh, somehow manifested from Thad's subconscious. professorial colleague Reggie, played by Julie Harris, explains to Thad that George Stark is his dark half, and that the sparrows are a connection between the land of the living and the land of the dead, which is credited for something known as psychopumps. And now Stark wants to continue living and will stop at nothing to take over Thad's body and his life. So, yes, folks, that is the story of the Dark Half. You know, so, yes, the Dark Half was the beginning. Actually, well, I mentioned Monkey Shines was the beginning of George Romero's Hollywood career.
It was
his beginning in terms of getting a film picked up by a major studio or a mini major in this case.
Yeah, and Iron, who was having so much financial issues.
Oh, yes. They kept that a secret because by the time Dark Half was put into production and before it was nearly finished, Orion had filed Chapter 11 and pretty much didn't have any more money. But
if memory serves me right, weren't they also having issues back in 88 and 89?
Yeah, they were. They were having some financial stuff. They were keeping a lot of things secret. I mean, they were still plugging away, getting movies made and releasing, but they weren't quite getting the huge... Orion had basically huge success with movies like The Terminator and Platoon and...
RoboCop,
and to a certain extent Return of the Living Dead. But this was at a point where, you know, the mini-major of independent films was sort of changing, and they were trying to stay afloat. They were kind of up there with movies with companies like Canon Pictures and Charlie Band's Empire Pictures. But the Dark Half represented Romero's, I guess you can say, entry into Hollywood, because this was basically being financed by a Hollywood studio. I have to say, I think it's a valiant Hollywood attempt from Romero at the time. Mm. I mean, I got to be honest. I like the Dark Half. I like the Dark Half a lot more than Monkey Shines.
I will agree with you wholeheartedly there. I enjoyed the Dark Half a lot, basically because I love Timothy Hutton's performance in this.
Yeah, he is good in this. Even though Timothy Hutton and George Romero didn't quite see eye to eye on things on here, Timothy Hutton was more of a method actor, and Romero was more. More accustomed to the whole they rehearse and they perform and that kind of thing.
I've read some things where where Tim just walked off set a couple of times.
Yeah, well, there was one incident where, like, if Timothy came on set playing the character, just to sum this up, Timothy Hutton plays Thad Beaumont and he plays the George Stark character, to sort of set up the whole thing about the whole twin aspect.
Right.
So, whenever Timothy Hutton would come on set as Thad, he would want people to call him Thad, you know? Method acting. Being character the whole time.
Yeah.
And if he showed up as George Stark, he wanted people to call him George, and he would act like George Stark even before the camera was rolling. So,
okay, I can see that, yeah.
I mean, I have to be honest, I'm not a big fan of method acting because I think it's just, you know, it's one of those things where, and I agree with what Romero said, where he said, you know, method actors want to play it to the point where they want everything like down perfect, but it's like, no, you have to train yourself to be, you know, on when the cameras are rolling. You don't have to go through that whole thing like when the cameras are off. You know, it's like what I was listening to the audio commentary of Romero on The Dark Half. He was talking about Romero's brief cameo in Silence of the Lambs. And he talked
about the lotion in the basket.
Yeah. And he talked about the scene watching Anthony Hopkins act. And Anthony Hopkins was not a method actor. He was a classic studio, you know, theater-trained actor. Mm-hmm. Where, like, before they'd shoot a scene, he'd see Anthony Hopkins sitting on the side reading a book. And then well, they'd say, okay, we're ready, Anthony. And action. Puts the book down, gets up, does his lines, well-trained. And then when they say cut, sits back down, picks the book up. And that's what Romero's talking about when he says that, you know, like, it's method acting doesn't train you to know your it doesn't train you to have your character I guess you can say on like basically locked it, mm-hmm. it method acting wants you to just like it's like what with Dustin Hoffman where he would like I think it was Marathon Man where in order for him to be tired to play the scene tired he would have to run around and get tired as opposed
to Marathon Man
as opposed to what you know I forget what, maybe it was Laurence Olivier or somebody said to him, why don't you just try acting and pretending, you know? I mean, that's the thing about what I was saying with Anthony Hopkins and the story that George Romero told was that Anthony Hopkins went off the script, he knows his character, he knows when to be on or off, when it's appropriate. And that's what I was saying about with Timothy Hutton, and that, you know, with method acting, he wanted to be on the whole time. You know? But with that said, getting back on subject here, with that said, I do like Timothy Hutton's performance in here. Yeah. So
I thought it was strong, and I felt bad for George Stark's character, and you're to the point where you're flip flopping. You don't know, is it really George Stark? Is it really George just committing these crimes and then, you know, not remembering it?
I thought so too.
It was just very bizarre. It's like I was rooting for it. It's like, please don't let this be George. Because, I mean, all signs are pointed to him being,
well,
you know.
Well, you kind of like George Stark
character. You want him to succeed. You want him to.
But the problem is that his character becomes just too, I guess you can say, just too uncontrolled. Like basically, basically the Thad Beaumont character, when he tells the press how he conceived the character and how he creates the George Stark character. Mm-hmm. You know, he says that, you know, he basically allows himself to think like him, to try to be like him and everything.
Right. And that brings up to the point where he talks to his wife.
Yeah. But he tries to make it understand that that's all in the back of his mind. That's what he's trying to control.
Right. You know? And then when he was talking to his wife, she goes, I don't like when you write those books because you become a completely different person.
Yes.
And that struck me like, oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Because of the drinking and the smoking and the swearing.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of almost method acting when he's writing.
Writing method. Yes.
Exactly.
It does help with it, too.
So that kind of correlates what you were saying before.
Right. The thing about it is that when George Stark character goes about starting to kill people, I like that character, but it's like Jesus Christ.
And George Stark is one mean SOB.
Mean Southern boy.
Yeah. Oh my God. And he drives this. What kind of car does he drive?
Tornado. He's got a Tornado.
Oh my God. With the tagline, was it with the,
like, a tuned up son of a bitch, something like that?
Yeah, and he is just mean.
Oh my God.
He's ruthless. He's a ruthless killer.
But he was an amusing character.
Yeah.
He was very mean.
Yeah, and there's this, and to I'm sorry, I'm losing my train of thought here. So he goes to confront, and he's trying, no, he's being framed pretty much because the fingerprints and the blood are all matching.
Yeah, Thad's being framed for that, basically.
George is matching Thad's fingerprints.
Well,
fingerprints,
they're matching because their characters are basically twins,
right?
Or at least the George Stark is a manifestation.
Right. So basically, then you're introduced to the character Michael Rooker. Michael Rooker's character, the sheriff. Now, truthfully, he is the one I felt for the most. Because he's trying to give poor George, the benefit of the doubt without trying to get
tell it's very hard for him because the situation within the story is unusual because he says your fingerprints are there but you're supposed to be here. What's going on? And I gotta say, I liked Michael Rooker in this film. I mean, he is I like his performances in general.
Yeah.
He was really fun in Slither. Was fun in he was really good in the Walking Dead.
Yeah, playing the racist Merle.
Yeah, well, racist Merle, but actually ends up becoming very sympathetic in some cases.
Well, at the very, very end of his.
Well, at the very, very end of his character. Yeah. But it's interesting that Romero actually wanted Michael Rooker to play the Thad Beaumont George Stark. Yeah, but Orion didn't buy it because Michael Rooker had gained a lot of fame from playing in the movie Henry, A Portrait of a Serial Killer. That was his first role. And he was starting to play bad guys. And they were like, we can't see him as anything but a bad guy. So
Then this was perfect because I completely bought him as a straight-laced
the
family man cop or the sheriff in the small town.
Telling him to give him a break while he's trying to.
He's bringing beer over. He's like, you got to tell me what's going on because I want to give you the benefit of the doubt.
All
the evidence is mounting against you.
His character is
I don't
want
to have to pull you down to the station.
Right. His character is very likable. It's testing his will.
Yeah. And he's like, I'm just waiting for him to flip out, you know, just kind of break.
And, I liked Amy Madigan as the wife in this, too. She was pretty good.
Although, whoever gave the wardrobe, I mean, I know it was the 90s, but that wardrobe that she wore was horrendous.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It was what it was.
The pant suits and the pleats with the.
Yeah.
It looked awful.
And there's a lot of fun moments. I like the scene. The scene I like is when his publisher. Because he gets his publisher, the Thad Beaumont's publisher, gets a phone call from George Stark, and now the publisher's all worried and everything. And he goes over and he's trying to grab a smoke at this big piano, and there's a window, and the cleaning the cleaning crew thing. Yeah. The device is coming down, and you think his drone Stark.
The window washers.
Well, I'm trying to forget the lift. Basically.
Yeah, the lift. Yeah.
And he turns around, and you think it's George Stark, but it's really the cleaning guy. And he's like, "Hey, have," and he holds the sign up saying, "Have a nice day." He says, "You asshole!" And he goes, "Fuck you!" And then, but that comes in later when George Stark comes in, and I love the line where George Stark says, "I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to terminate a relationship." It's a cutthroat business after cutting the guy's throat.
Yeah, I mean, George Stark was, I mean, not George Stark, George Stark was the killer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm drawing a blank.
You did watch the movie, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm getting confused between the Timothy Hutton's character.
Yeah, well, that's because they do a pretty good job for its time seamlessly making them.
Right. In the same. But no, I loved the film. I thought it was wonderful.
Now I'm gonna say, I do think that the whole thing involving, even though it is sort of like the what makes the movie, or what makes the story, is the whole thing involving the brain. You know, basically the tumor found in Thad's brain.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting concept. Because then, of course, you know, they get rid of the eye and the teeth, one of which has a cavity, and as one of the doctors said. By the way, how does the doctor figure that out? You're a brain surgeon. You're not a dentist.
Yes. Oh, okay. So we're moving to that plot point where George is going to go visit the original doctor.
Well, no, not that. Just the idea of the connection between that. And the birds, it's kind of getting a little out there, but it's an interesting idea. I didn't hate it. I'm just saying, but then, you know, they remove the tumor and everything, and then somehow, you know, George Stark becomes this manifestation. George Stark somehow becomes real,
right?
And then there's this, we get to the doctor, and then the doctor explains that, you know, or it's sort of explained that the site of Thad's family burial plot, supposedly. Even though there's no gravesite there, is the burial where the remains were buried at? Because if we remember, once they're done putting George Stark to bed, or faking his death, the next day the caretaker finds out that the ground has been opened up, and it's indicated that George Stark emerged from the ground there. Right.
And obviously, at that point, the cops are thinking it's just vandalism.
But they're trying to connect that with the tumor and everything, and it's kind of odd. I mean, it doesn't quite flow together. I mean, it's an interesting idea, but that's one part of the film where I was kind of like, it's okay.
Right.
I mean,
well, then you see the thing where Timothy Hutton's character is teaching in a class, and you see. This mysterious stranger in the back of the classroom.
Oh yeah.
This kind of sets the whole thing into motion.
Oh, it does. It's what pushes it. You know, and, played by the Fred Clausen, played by Robert Joy, who's really fun in the scene. Yeah, he's pretty sleazy.
Right. And he gets his by good old Georgie. gets his old Columbia necktie, I believe.
No, he's
sitting down in the chair.
Yeah, no. What he does is he. Well, if you remember.
No, obviously I don't, because I'm having a drawing of blank.
There's the scene where Timothy Hutton and the Thad Beaumont character is upset about the whole thing, and he says to the babies, you know, he's just saying it for fun, like, you know what George Stark would do? He would go over and cut Fred Clausen's little pecker off and stick it down his throat, because that's what they do to people who talk.
Right, okay.
You know, that's a gangland knockoff kind of thing. And then that's what happens to Fred Clausen's character is they find him. You see the back of him sitting in the chair, and then the camera pans over and you see the shadow of him. You see something sticking out his mouth through the shadow, and then of course
And then you pan to the wall. It says the sparrows are coming.
The sparrows are flying. Alan Pangborn, played by Michael Rooker, explains. And he was killed classic gangland style, where his penis was cut off and stuck down his throat. And of course, Thad says, "I." Wanted that to actually happen to Fred Clausen, which incriminates him a lot more. It's like, you should have kept your mouth shut, buddy. Jesus.
Oh, my God.
But, let's talk, you know, since we're getting to the near end here, let's talk about the film's ending.
Yes. Now, I want to say that was intense, because we've seen movies in the past where you know, where the two characters merge together, and then all of a sudden, kind of like almost in Fight Club style, like you realize that Edward Norton's really fighting himself instead of fighting Brad Pitt. And I was expecting that, and you totally don't get that. That's what I was expecting all along in this film.
Yeah.
And you actually see the showdown between Thad and George, and they meet at the with their lake house, I think, right? That's where they are.
Yeah.
And there's just a battle going on, and then the cops or Michael Rooker's characters show up, and the place is ablaze, and the sparrows are flying.
Yeah,
and
the sparrows are flying all around the house.
I mean, it's going crazy.
I think it's a pretty good big finale.
Yeah, it was a very satisfying finale.
Yeah.
The tension that slowly builds with the kids with the babies on the floor because they take because at one point George takes it kind of kidnaps Thad and the kids and they go into his secret writing room.
Yeah.
He's like, we're gonna write one more book, and you can see as much as Thad is writing, George is getting healthier because he's
trying to take over Thad's life.
Yeah,
and that's,
so because you see. Basically, just to backtrack for a second, you see Thad Beaumont's character, George Stark's character at the beginning is this really southern, like, tough guy, but then you see him starting to fall apart.
Yeah, he's slowly deteriorating.
Going into nothingness. And then as they're sitting there writing the book in the study, it's like they're switching, roles reversing.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a great. I mean, I like the finale of it. I think Romero did a pretty good job considering that the Orion Pictures was basically at the near end told them that we're running out of money. But it's interesting too. This film actually had some early CGI, which I didn't quite know about. Some of the bird shots were early CGI, which weren't bad. I have to say, for early CGI, it wasn't really awful.
Really, and truthfully, that's the only little knock I'll give against it. And it's not because, I can say it's because of the time, and thankfully it was used minimally at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
But talking about that final scene where they're battling each other and the sparrows are coming through just blasting through this house, and the cop is sitting there watching in awe, like he doesn't know what the hell's going on.
Well, would you?
Yeah, I mean, because he's thinking to arrest Thad, and then all of a sudden you see these two guys duking it out, and these birds are flying around just tearing apart George,
tearing apart George Stark piece by piece. Yeah,
and that was brutal.
And the original ending was supposed to be. And again, another example of test screenings, and why I pretty much agree with Romero. Test screenings are practically useless because it doesn't really help you that much. I mean, it gives audiences a viewpoint of what they may see, but it's like usually the opinions audiences give are very, I guess you could say, too half-hearted. But the original ending was that all the birds were, they attacked George Stark, and then they were going to carry him away
to the supernatural
world. Yeah. But when they test screened it, all the optical effects weren't finished yet. And so it was basically a rough cut. And when they showed the rough cut of it, the audience basically said, we hate the ending. And then, of course, in classic style where it's like, well, it wasn't finished yet. You didn't see the finished ending. So Orion said, why don't you just have the birds tear him apart? And that's what they did. The birds do tear him apart with the exception of half the rib cage, which go flying up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So... But, that basically was the original ending, was the birds were going to carry George Stark up in the air, but it didn't happen.
What I want to know is who's going to write that police report and how do you do that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, so where's the criminal? Funny thing about that.
And what does the sheriff say? He's like, there was a bad guy. He killed a lot of people. It wasn't George. It wasn't Thad. It was George, but George isn't here because some birds ripped him apart and took him to the sky.
And that's what makes it so weird. But the film is supposed to have this supernatural or strange aspect to it. I did like this movie a lot more than Monkey Shines. It was an interesting, I guess you can say, introduction for Romero in Hollywood, because that was during this period where after this film, which Orion Pictures didn't do much with when they released it. Romero left Pittsburgh and went to Hollywood, where he basically spent a part of that period just writing scripts for films that never got made, which is a shame because that was when he was really trying to get the industry to back him. And he talks about that in the audio commentary for The Dark Half, where he talks about his adventures in Hollywood. It's just very interesting where he said that he was being hired by Warner Brothers and you know, they would say, just write us scripts. And he was being paid for it, but...
Right. I know he was also hired by, I think it was Screen Gems or Sony to write a Resident Evil transcript.
Yeah, and it never happened.
Script.
I think he wrote it, but it never
happened.
He did
write it because I read it.
Yeah, and then he told some fun stories about... He told one story about how he was trying to do one movie. I forget what it was called now. And they took it to, like, one of the agents at the studio, and they're like, yeah, you know, it was supposed to be for Meryl Streep.
Okay.
And at that time, Meryl Streep was doing very well. And the agents there said, nope, don't want to get Meryl Streep. She's yesterday's pizza, quote unquote. And Romero said, the guy told him, why don't you write this and tailor it for that that one girl, that... That Aussie, what's her name? She was in that movie with the boat, and Romero said, oh, Nicole Kidman? And they're like, yeah, tailor it for her and bring it to us. So he said he wrote it, so he went back and rewrote it to tailor it for Nicole Kidman and brought it like a few weeks back to the guy. And the guy said, nope, Nicole Kidman, yesterday's pizza. It was just like, it was like Romero was writing these scripts trying to get films made. Like at one point, he was involved with The Mummy. I'm sure if you remember that one.
With Brendan Fraser?
Before Brendan Fraser got involved with that.
But that movie, though.
Movie. And they were going to greenlight. And it actually got greenlit. And Romero wrote the script, but it never got made. Or at least his version of it never got made because they made another deal. Romero made another deal with another studio. And the two studios didn't want to come to an agreement. And they basically terminated the deal.
So basically, all these studios got all these original Romero works just sitting on somebody's desk in a vault somewhere.
Well, it was one of those things where Romero said that he didn't have any, despite the fact that he did have that quote unquote legendary status of being a, you know, this filmmaker, he wasn't getting any, he didn't have any clout in the business to get these things going.
That's strange and sad at the same time.
It's strange and sad, but it's, oh God, talk about the business. Sheesh. But yeah, he told some fun stories about that. I just laughed when he told a story about the Nicole Kidman thing. Yeah, what's this, tale of this story for this, what's that Aussie woman's name? She was in that movie and it was about the boat and Romero's like, oh, you mean Nicole Kidman? Yeah, tale of it for her. And he said, I wrote some on the shrimp on the Bobby and that kind of thing. And brought it to him. He goes, no, yesterday's pizza. It's like, Jesus Christ.
Well, have you ever had yesterday's pizza? Heat it up in the microwave.
Yes,
it's delicious.
Pizza is not bad. Well, that's funny, too, because, you know, Timothy Hutton, in a way, they talk about this in the commentary, was sort of, not quite, but sort of yesterday's pizza. Because he had done Ordinary People, which was back in the 80s, which was a good movie, you know, I mean, with Miro Tyler Moore and everything. But they were like, you know, basically saying, well, you got to get a name for this movie. And Timothy Hutton was still a name, but he wasn't quite like in a lot of hit movies, I don't think, during that period. So it was very odd how the business thinks about that. You're trying to write a script for Meryl Streep that's doing...
and we've talked about this before, but maybe that's what's contributing to why most of the movies in the 90s kind of sucked.
Oh, yeah, probably. Well, I think it's also a case of where... You know, I think now the industry, they tend to want to focus more on, you know, the star power, which is fine. But it's like, you know, you can't, you know, big stars star in movies that end up being good or end up being bad, you know, whatever. It's hard to make a great film with a big star power on it. And that's kind of the thing that Romero experienced during his Hollywood phase or the beginning of that phase. But at that time, because like I said, he wrote a script that was going to be for Meryl Streep. And the guy said... Nah, she's yesterday's news. Write something for this other person. And it's like, what, are you kidding me? I mean, at that time, Meryl Streep was doing fairly well in the 90s. You don't want to, you know, miss out on that boat. And then
she was huge in Death Becomes Her.
Well, yeah. No, but I mean, like, she was doing well at that period. Yeah.
She was successful. Yeah.
And then the guy says, go write something for Nicole Kidman, who was, you know, coming up at that point. And you come back and you're still being told, no, not good enough. And it's like, well, okay, man, what's it going to take?
Right. Well, I guess Hollywood for you.
But yeah, I enjoyed The Dark Half. I thought that was a fun little movie from him. And again, something different from Romero.
So your final review, how many stars are?
Oh, I'm going to give it 4.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to give it a solid A. I enjoyed it a lot. I thought it was a lot of fun. It definitely kept me on my toes, and I was expecting something different, and I got a different outcome. So I was pleasantly surprised. Let's just put it that way. I had Monkey Shines was fun, but this was better.
Yeah, I mean, I will agree. So
all right. So I guess if you would like to send us an email, you can at the thathorrorshowpodcast@gmail.com or email us through our official Facebook page at That Horror Show Podcast. We would love to hear from you guys. All our shows are now available for download through iTunes and Stitcher.com. You can read our movie reviews and television reviews on our Tumblr at thathorrorshow.tumblr.com. Or that show, I'm sorry, thathorrorshowpodcast.tumblr.com. Right now, currently, there's only one up there. It's just my micro review of Adam Green's 2010 film Frozen. But stay tuned. More reviews will be added shortly. So, Chris, do you have anything else to add?
No, I'd say that's about it. So
then this does it for this episode. We'll be back next month with a brand new episode called That Stalker Episode. Pop stars and novelists, watch out. They're your number one fan.
Oh, boy. So do you want me to mention what the title is?
Yeah, why don't we mention the title
of
the
movie? Well, we're reviewing two films that involve, stalkers and fan obsessions. One is called The Fan from the early 80s. A German horror film about fan obsession, how far it goes. And then we have another one that we're going to be doing, which is Misery, the classic.
Maybe you've heard of it.
Yes, maybe you've heard of that.
Kathy Bates?
Kathy Bates, James Caan in it.
Sledgehammer?
Know? Yeah.
Ring a bell?
Oh, yeah. So we'll be reviewing those two films.
All right. Well, with that, good night, and we'll see you guys next month.
Take care, everybody.
All right.
Thanks for listening.
Oh, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, gun. You thought I was going to say son of a bitch, didn't you?